You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. On the Cosmic Circus Fake Radio Network. Mrs. Elizabeth Quailfight owned a gentleman's boarding house in Portland, where I lived for a while. She was actually unmarried, but she introduced herself as Mrs. Quailfight. She actually introduced herself as Madam Quailfight, but then quickly disqualified its use as being too arduous for the tongues of hard-working men. I was doing a stint as King Lear at the Strand, and would get back to the house in the early hours, strange feeling and discombobulated, still preferring to mumble Lear's lines rather than my own. The difficulty with Lear, as not with Hamlet, or really any of the others, is how it stabs into you and won't have removal. Thus, it was a very brief joke of mine, more to myself, as I rarely spoke to anyone, to say that I'd been leered and would soon have to go down in not my own, but his flames of madness. At any rate, Lizzie Quailfight would always be up, awaiting my return, drunk and hung heavy into a soft chair on the unlit porch. Her home was on a still cobbled street in a dark part of downtown, and although the city had begun to convert forwardly into a Bordeaux exclusively populated by box-glass monsters, there were still wooden homes here and there. Great three-storied affairs that, if they were kitted outright, could house maybe 20 or 30 gentlemen. I would halt, smelling the sweaty waft of her midnight cigar, the pine tree mist of her gin and tonic. Standing 10 yards distant, we would speak together as though I were not a resident, but a passer-by to briefly enjoin, her cigar winking its hot eye. "Good night, was it, Sherwin?" she would ask. "Very good. Cheer for you, did they, Sherwin?" "Stood for me. Packed house, too. No one could ever stand for me," she said, and laughed. "Nor I for them, but I might for you, Sherwin. Though not now, of course, as I can hardly stay awake for you." She laughed again. Although her tone was bitter, and she was almost always perceived as being bitter, she was not. Rather, she was ironic and absurd, but this cosmetic sheen was rarely, if ever, discerned. Hers was a type of sour and very un-American rhetoric, better suited, or only known to suit, a certain kind of internationally successful man, or perhaps a cowboy. I was amazed that she never tried to set anyone straight. She never said, "Just joking," as I seemed always to be saying, as people didn't quite follow my own irony, and I could never seem to give up its crutch. "Did you get lucky?" she said. By this she meant with a woman. "Not yet," I'd say, invitingly, if not moving forward, then pushing my chest and face toward her in minutest courting. Didn't go drinking afterward, did you, Sherwin? Mrs. Quailfight loved stories of drinking, even when they were banal. I had a little something at the Plow and Stars, I said. Ah, she said, deeply pleased that I had been naughty. Naughty, in the world's eyes, was right as rain in hers. Just an Irish beer, I said. Maybe followed by a Scottish whiskey or two. Something to unwind, to try to blow that leer out of my gunnels. Maybe another beer to be polite at the end. You may come up, sir, she'd say. Thank you, Lizzie, I would always reply. It was our ritual that I would continue standing just outside the small iron-wrought fence that enclosed her garden until invited in, as though the conversation were a kind of elaborate password, and she was making sure that I was, in fact, the Sherwin Sleeve she recollected, the one who understood her ironic self. In fact, in the subtler cloth, there was something uniquely warming and cheerful about speaking from the distance. For us too, with the sort of ginger attraction we shared, who were unaccompanied in life, and would remain so in all likelihood, we who were mystified by congregations, by that long length the world was intent on marching, having forgotten the pleasure of its own width. It was the best approach, like two nomadic lions meeting in the wilderness after long stretches of isolation. And yourself, Lizzie, I would always ask upon sitting. Usually she would stretch out a leg to touch my own, and sometimes I would feel the naked skin of her shoeless heel pressing down into my hand. I usually just held her foot like that, kindly, but not encouragingly. There was a danger to all else, but I did, I must admit, sometimes stroke the top of her foot or place my other hand across it. Me? She said, innocently. Nothing, just me. Number 9, she'd say, raising the gin and tinkling its tiny ice bells. She always put me on the track of her drink count. Even the following day she would update me. 2 more after you went up. Usually one of the tenants was in duress or involved in some unpleasantness, and we would gossip amiably of their troubles. Baron Markovitz was a man in his early 30s, very bright but very peculiar. He was perpetually in terrible trouble with anyone you could be in trouble with. His parents, his ex-wife, his children, the police, the collection agencies, and Lizzie Quailfight herself, though she always insisted that he do her the honor of being the least of his problems. There was never any clearly bad news that would put him away for good, but a subtle ravaging complexity of problems that seemed to wrap all around everything he touched. And, too, his troubles and the way they seemed to overlay and entrap one another made it seem impossible that he could ever unbind his central problem, which, as far as I could detect, had something to do with a bar tab. His troubles had led into a trauma around his wife, and then he'd done something that his children had seen, and then he'd taken something from his place of work, and then suddenly he'd come to Lizzie to tell her that he could not pay his weekly rent, as the police had confiscated his suitcase, within which was a special passcode to his deposit box at the local First National Bank, and that furthermore, within the deposit box, was the one piece of exonerating evidence that would allow him to set it all straight and get out of the entire mess. All of this entrenching mire and fabulation was for us a welcome confirmation, an exaggeration of what we both knew in our hearts to be the underlying state of the world. For the world, we knew, was not a stable theory. I remember only one lengthy exchange with Baron Markovitz. He lived on the 3rd floor, and I on the 2nd, and we'd nod our hellos in the stairs or landing. We ignored each other out of doors. But he lingered once in the 2nd floor lobby, seeing me fiddling with my keys at my door. Stepping into the hall, he began to touch whatever objects he could find, as though the curio cabinet or the landscape painting had some draw for him. "Did you ever get the feeling that things aren't working out right?" he said to me suddenly. "Do you mean for me?" I asked. "You, me, everyone. Like something's just not right. Like something's going on that we don't know about." I don't know. I just can't believe this is it. This is what's going on? What it's all about? This right here? What we've created for ourselves? I guess I'm just surprised. I could see the deep dissatisfaction on his face. If he was desperate, he was not quiet about it. He stepped closer, and I looked forcibly into his eyes. He was aggressive and physical, and I felt I had to hold him back in this manner, by gaze. "You see," he said, and his arms fell out wide, as though to say he was both hiding nothing and had nothing left to offer. "I'd cry," he said, confessionally. "You might think I would. Why wouldn't I? I have every reason. But my heart can shatter before I let those bastards see me go down like that. I will not weep. I'll go crazy first. Before any tear goes from these eyes, I'll go crazy. I'll lose the way I want to lose. Nuts to them." And then Baron Markovitz quickly turned and left. Into the silence, I said, "Yes." In bed later that night, without effort, the lines from Lear returned with a strange recklessness. "You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or ere I'll weep. Oh, fool, I shall go mad." I recited the line several times before I realized what had happened. I don't know if Baron Markovitz was playing with me, or whether his life had all along been so collisioning with Lear's, or that there were King Lear's all around us, reciting his lines in their own private form as they came to their own private dead ends. The following night, my performance was marred. As I entered Scene 4, Act 2, with the fool and gentleman attending, all standing before Gloucester's castle, with Kent before us in the stocks, I began my monologue rightly, but took a turn toward Baron Markovitz, a turn that felt at the moment to be a type of consummation, of myself marrying into the world. "And let not women's cheeks, water drops, stain my man's cheeks. No, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both, that all the world shall. I will do such things. What they are, yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth." I'd cry. You might think I would. Why wouldn't I? I have every reason. But my heart can shatter before I let the bastards see me go down like that. I will not weep. I'll go crazy first. Before any tear goes from these eyes, I'll go crazy. I'll lose the way I want to lose. Nuts to them. It was selfish and bad form. A transgression that could not be forgiven. That was my last performance of Lear. When I got home, Lizzie Queelfight was in her place as usual, cigar and drink smell draping the cobbled street. As I stood at the fence, waiting for her to speak, I realized she was not alone. I could hear the low rumble of a deep male voice. Baron Markovitz, I thought. I stepped loudly through the gate, announcing my presence. But their soft murmuring continued. I could see that Lizzie had stretched her leg out, and that Baron was stroking it, rather much higher than I'd ever dared. Struck cold was I when I heard her utter, "Oh, Sherwin, why'd take so long to move such a short distance?" I was standing before them on the porch in the darkness. Did she mean me? "And then," the male figure said, "as I stood to take my bows, I saw that my laces were undone." "I should come to see you, Sherwin," Lizzie said, "though I don't care for plays." At this, the man reached forward, Lizzie propped against her drunken elbows, and the man half stood. Their two mouths moved together. I was not a foot away, watching them kiss. My body soaked into the air, and I realized it was possible that, in fact, I had already arrived, and that further, in some fit of drinking and the delusions of playing Lear, that it was, after all, myself engaged in this amorous activity with the woman I had, on the slowest burner setting, been courting. I floated in my position, out of body, watching myself then move in again to kiss her again. My first intimate encounter had me present only in the background. As our lips touched, I did not taste the smoke salt of her mouth or feel the soft feminine skin of her cheek. But I was consoled. At least it was me. That was nice, Sherwin, Lizzie said, as our faces briefly parted. My voice cracked the whip of silence, a shock to the air, vibrant, metallic, and upsetting. That was nice, I echoed. Sherwin, Baron Markovitz suddenly stood, our eyes locked as they had in the hallway during our most profound encounter. Baron, I said, on the spot, my bones soft rotted. My skin slid down. Baron made for the door quickly. Wasn't it me? I heard myself say. Lizzie tumbled back into her chair. I was now roving and hovering in space as to my own private earthquake. I thought it was you, Sherwin, Lizzie said. I thought it was you. I reached for, but was not even close to grabbing hold of her foot. I thought it was me too, I said. I learned recently, during a visit to the Elder Woods Preserve, of the people in the trees. I do not mean here a wild or exotic people who swing on vines and arabesque with monkey-like precision about the forest canopy. Nor do I mean the modern-day exponents of civil disobedience, those who take to the branch in a skylarking form of protest. No, I mean a sort of almost entirely unknown species of outdoorsman, like a hiker or backpacker, but who, rather than escaping trails and sleeping on mountain points, climbs a tree and camps. Why it should be that so many persons are climbing into the high branches of trees, I'm sure I don't know. I suppose a vestigial, ancestral remnant of a long-ago species of tree-dwelling human is at work or play here. The subtle echoes of our former selves continue to reverberate in strong and soft waves everywhere. Whatever the case, I found myself in Elder Woods, strolling down no path, just flat-sticking my way here and there, bushwhacking, because that is something that I do to tap the resource and become the more pleasant, because exhausted, version of myself. The less of me there is to exert, I have noted, the more content I am. The brush was thick, and the leaves still dripped with rain from a recent storm. I had a small pack with lunch, and I had set for myself the duty of a few hours' wander. No destination in particular for me, no onward and upward. I may travel in circles. I'll go left for a while and then right, forward and then back. There is a saying, in order to travel 1 mile east, you must travel 1 mile west. That is the sort of manner in which I go. After a time, I found myself at the base of a tall oak. I sat, had some water, and gazed at the tockling nearby brook, and, as often I do, I dreamed up some Indians to wander by with their graceful seriousness and bare feet, all the while trying to imagine what a lifelike life like that might be like. "Hello, Ted," I heard suddenly and distantly from the sky above. I coptered about in a kind of irritated frenzy. I do not like to be come upon, have never liked spooking. I looked up and saw nothing but the expected sticks and leaves and the sunburnt green greasy animation of the Storm 6 sky. "Hello," I called upwardsly. "It's coming," the voice assured me. "Just a little stuck." "Fine," I called back. I have been involved in dozens of curious encounters, mirages and so forth. Unknown people accosting me with furious reports of my sordidness. I've always replied in this singular way. I always say, "Fine." It seems to me a kind of quiet button, a word that pats out a deaf space, as though with a stroke I may put a blanket over the peculiarity and send it spinning off to sleep. But I could see it now, a bucket attached by colorful climber's rope, slowly bounding through the branchy heights of the huge oak. "How's everything?" said the faraway voice. "Fine," I said again, watching the swinging bucket spin above my head and then drop rushingly toward my feet. It was a wooden pail of the sort that might be used in an old-fashioned well. "Did you bring ham?" the voice in the tree asked, a little petulant, as though I might be served some trouble if I hadn't. Coincidentally, my sandwich was ham. "Yes," I called up. I rummaged out my lunch. Perhaps it's the improvisational, theatrical insouciance within me, but I'm incapable of not going along with incredible activities, no matter their requirement, until I've deciphered their heart song for myself. I would give up my lunch to crack this case. I put the sandwich and a little vial of milk into the bucket. "Prepared," I said, and tugged the rope as though here we were at the secret clubhouse. The bucket rose. "Feels light, Ted," the voice said, threatening. "Or is the pillow aboard?" Was the pillow aboard? I wondered how to address this. "Ted," the voice said. "Is that you, Ted?" One of the problems with human-based mysteries is that they often involve other humans who might equally find your presence to be a mystery, and before you can figure them out, they're demanding to see your papers. And, despite my purest devotion to mystery, I would not lie. That violated the rules of discovery. So I told him who I was, and, after a spell of silence, he invited me to come up. He informed me that on the far side was a string of pegs that would take me safely up to the second floor, as he called it, and that between the second floor and the eighth floor there were plenty of branches. So easy was it to ascend the middle portion of the tree that even his old grandmother could make it, despite being dead and despite having no working leg of her own for the last few years of her life. He was a garrulous man high up in a tree. I gripped the rough bark and step-swung up the rudimentary pegging and made my way to the second floor where, as he said, a staircase of sorts could be discerned, spiraling upward. As I rose, and all along, he continued his monologue. "This is an oak, obviously," he said. "I usually go for pine. I actually like sap, even on my hands. Some wear gloves, but not me. But pines aren't that tall, and because I wanted to stay for a while, I decided I wanted tall. So, Oak, you can call me Nathan, Nathan Bighead." I was probably at around what Nathan termed the sixth floor, when I came upon a too distant space between the branches. He was 20 feet yet above me. "Nathan Bighead," I said, in a tone that also served him notice that I intended to go no further. "It's my tree name," he said, "and also, if you haven't noticed," he now tapped his very large, very bright smiling skull, "I have a big head, and I just wanted to get it out of the way. If I was fat, I guess I'd be Nathan Fat, or Nathan Fatso. I mean, my real name is something else, but not up here. Not up here." "Are you in the tree because of your head?" I asked. "Hmm," Nathan Bighead said. "I'm sure it had something to do with it, but it wasn't the main cause. I just find that I prefer it. I climbed trees as a kid, one of my favorite things. Stopped at high school. Didn't think about it for 30 years. I made a lot of money and still, I've had a lot of trouble. A difficult time with people and the world. I'm just an uneasy person. Even if I had a normal-sized head, there's some other problem. I just didn't like it. Didn't like my house, my car. Never liked TV that much, or books, or plays, or really even talking, or having friends. I do like a little music, and sometimes I have Ted play me a song." "What song is that?" I asked. But Nathan hadn't heard me, or chose not to reply. "I don't even really like snacks," he continued. "People never believe me on that one." I shrugged. But as Nathan seemed to want to go on with this, I prompted him with a, "Really?" And so prompted, he continued. "Not cake, not candy, not cookies. I mean, I don't mind eating. I don't mind functions. I just don't care to have lollipops or gum or pie in my mouth. Doesn't do anything or mean anything to me. To me, it's like holding a red or yellow ball, as random as that. Like, oh, for dessert, I think I'll go hold a pink-colored ball." "I see," I said. "So," Nathan continued, "I didn't feel like things were jibing, and one day, it just came over me. I didn't even think about it. I put my briefcase down and climbed the nearest sycamore out in front of my house. I liked that, at least. And for a couple weeks, I just climbed the tree in my yard. But then I thought, I don't want to be looking down Grayton Terrace at cars and telephone poles and pavement. And I don't want it looking at me. I want a real forest. So here I am. I've climbed most of these. This is the first one I've spent time in." "And how long have you been here?" I asked. "About 4 months. I'm pretty well to do," Nathan Bighead said. "So I hired someone to bring me food, which is why I called you Ted. Ted comes every day. I lower the bucket, he fills it, and that's that. We don't even talk much. I write down what I want sometimes and put it in the bucket." A distant rustling brought a shiver to my spine, but I quickly assumed the noise was that of Ted's approach. But it was not Ted. Nathan, above me, by means of the flat of his hand, recommended silence. A woman strode into view, glanced left and right as though lost, blonde-haired, with a small knapsack on her back and a stick in one hand. Over one shoulder was a huge belt of some kind. She moved by the base of our tree without the slightest uplook. She continued into the forest and seemed relieved to see a large poplar about 40 yards off, which sprouted on the far side of the talkative brook where earlier I'd placed my imaginary Indians. "Karen," Nathan whispered to me now. "Haven't seen her in a couple weeks. That's her poplar. She doesn't know we're here. That's a utility belt the phone company hands out to get up the poles. She works for Adams Telco. I had Ted check her out. She's clear." "Fine," I whispered back. I wasn't sure what sort of clearance Ted had provided Nathan on Karen, but I resorted to my old silent maker. Karen stepped heedlessly into the stream, and on the far side, at the poplar base, she latched her great belt around her waist and began to ascend. Her boots were obviously spurred, and she moved quite rapidly up the mostly branchless poplar, banging her ankles into the trunk and then lifting the hoop of her belt. "How long will she stay?" I asked. Just tonight, Nathan said. Karen doesn't know we're here. Most of them don't. I may be the most in the know about this whole thing. Most of whom don't know about what? I asked. About each other. Most of the other tree people, he said. They just think it's them. Their own private, whatever, activity. The only thing is that they don't react too well when they find out about each other. So, I usually just keep my quiets. At that, Nathan tipped his big head back. He'd been sort of dancing on his branch the entire time, whether excited by the company or just to show off his branch-standing mastery. He pushed himself back from the mast, danced from one branch to the next, and then caught himself before he fell back. He did this several times until, awfully, he did fall back. I watched as Nathan Bighead plummeted 80 feet down through the crackling branches. He made no noise when he hit. I was breathless, trapped in terror. Vertigo dragged at me. I stumbled about my 6th-floor branch. I could not see Nathan below, but knew he must be dead. My mouth hung, and I gasped for air. My hands, I noticed, had both sprung blood. I had torn my skin, evidently, while tripping about. Karen remained calmly at her post and stated in her poplar, she had not, apparently, heard. Nathan? A voice now called from the bottom. And not a worried or terrified voice, a hopeful and somewhat exuberant one. Ted? I gasped. Are you lowering the bucket? I quickly scrambled for the colorful climber's rope, a loop of which was nestled in the branch above. I managed to free the bucket and began to fish it into the space where Nathan had just fallen. It seemed impossible to me that Nathan's body and collision with the earth was not extraordinarily obvious. Did you get the ham? I heard my voice crack. I did, and a pillow. Following the rules of the secret clubhouse, Ted yanked once on the rope, and I began to hoist the burdened bucket up. My bleeding hands hated the rope, and blood splattered along my wrists. Anything else for you, Mr. Bighead? Ted asked, his voice so innocent, so unaware of the recent terror, connected me further to the guilt I was feeling over Nathan's death. My hands were bloody, a man was dead, and I was trapped in some game of pulling up a bucket. With further guilt, and possibly because my horrified mind was seeking refuge, I began to wonder what strange and non-snack-like items were being sent my way via Nathan's pail. Anything for tomorrow, Nathan? Ted asked. I heard my voice, dry and weak, call out. The song, Ted. I'd like to hear the song. There was silence for a moment, and then the sound of guitar strings as Ted began to tune his instrument. I held the bloody rope in coils about my feet and peeked through the contents of the pail. Ham, bread, cheese, lettuce. No condiment, no dessert, no flavor of any kind. At first, I wasn't listening at all to the song Ted played, but soon enough, I was singing along too. It was the only way I would ever find of burying Nathan Bighead. I stayed in the tree that night and decided that with this one upward movement that I'd join them, the people of the trees. Hear me when it's in the land. In the pine, where the stars don't ever shine. I was hurting all night. been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. On the Cosmic Circus Fake Radio Network.